And we want to welcome you all to this first meeting of the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. And what a book to begin with. The Tragedy of Arthur by Arthur Phillips tells the story of a writer named Arthur Phillips who is struggling to come to terms with his father, a con artist who's been behind bars for most of Arthur's life and who's given him a long-held secret gift before he dies, an undiscovered play by William Shakespeare called The Tragedy of Arthur. Is it real, or is it his father's brilliant final fraud? The novel is written as a memoir, serving as an introduction to the play, and it includes the play itself. And I'm very pleased that Arthur Phillips could join us this evening in this Green Space event. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you so much.
And again, I invite the members of our audience to join in the discussion. If you have any questions or comments to make about something that we're discussing, please raise your hand and then join in. So, Arthur, did the idea for this novel start with the unknown play by Shakespeare?
Yeah, you know, I do remember walking down the street and thinking, I wonder if I could write a Shakespeare play.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I'll raise my hand if I'm joking. How about that? No, I am serious.
Well, there have been a couple of counterfeit Shakespeare plays.
There's a good history of it. William Ireland is one of the most famous ones. He almost pulled it off in the 17-somethings. Being a novelist means you walk around a lot doing nothing and then waiting for a moment where you go, oh, I wonder if I could do that. And so the thought did cross my mind. What would I have to learn? What would I have to study? What would I have to do to make even the most, you know, the barely most plausible Shakespeare play? What would it require?
But most people agree that Shakespeare was the greatest playwright that ever lived. And I know if I were aiming to write a book which included the manuscript, I would just aim a little lower.
There's no challenge in that. I mean, anybody could write it, you know, whip off a Sondheim or a...
Are you worried that
a quick Gilbert and Sullivan before before lunch? But
I wouldn't try Chekhov.
No,
and when Nabokov did Pale Fire, which is a brilliant book, which mm-hmm. includes a poem that he wrote, he didn't claim it was by Pushkin.
No, that's true. But Nabokov was kind of a loser. So obviously we can jump right past the part where it's a ridiculously impertinent and arrogant thing to try to do. I think we're all agreed. Let's move on.
Well, I just was wondering if you're worried that any anti-Stratfordians will add you to the list of possible real authors, along with Francis Bacon, Christopher Marlowe, the 6th Earl of Derby, and the 17th Earl of Oxford.
And Mr. Phillips from Minneapolis, yes.
Dana, Arthur's twin, goes through a phase in college where she denies that Shakespeare is the real author. So this is one of the things, obviously, that you wanted to deal with in this book, or play with.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the idea that he didn't write the plays is a wonderful story, and it's a wonderfully imaginative way to view the world. I can't go along with it because I don't think there's anything to it. But the people who do go into this, and there's a movie coming out about how Shakespeare didn't write the Shakespeare plays, it requires a worldview I can't quite get my head around. It requires a view of documents and names and conspiracies and secrets held over centuries. But it is a good story, and it did certainly make for an appealing way to have the novel turn in a certain direction at one point.
Well, the Arthur Phillips of your novel thinks that Shakespeare is overrated. That this is the character you've created, right?
Well, it depends how you... All right, so to begin, a few moments ago, you said everyone pretty much agrees he's the greatest playwright ever. I think that's not necessarily a helpful way to describe a great writer. And I don't think that it necessarily makes people want to read him. And I think that it makes people uncomfortable to discuss him. And I do think I'm speaking now as a non-fictional person, I guess, to the extent that I am a non-fictional person, I came to love Shakespeare a great deal while writing this book, but for my own reasons and as a devoted reader and not as the Shakespeare that had been driven down my throat all my life, as you said, everyone agrees he's the greatest writer, right? I don't think it makes a lot of sense as a description of him, and I don't think it makes a lot of sense for readers to try to approach and for viewers to try to approach him like that. I touched the microphone. Am I in trouble?
No. Shakespeare is one of many writers of his time, and Arthur wonders why he's, quote, now forced on us as the single greatest. How did he pull this scam, and who abetted?
I'm very interested in him as a real person.
Yeah.
And I think that the anti-Stratfordians miss a wonderful real-life story, which is that this guy did exist, and he did write plays. And who was he, and what did it mean for him to write these plays at the time? I find it fascinating that, for example, people of his time did not say, well, there's obviously the greatest writer that's ever lived walking down the street. They said, some people said, he's great, and other people said, he's all right, and some people said, he writes a lot of plays, and left it at that. And some people said, you know, he's so good, he's almost as good as Thomas Watson. But we don't have any of Thomas Watson. Watson's gone. It's all lost. So who was this guy Shakespeare? He wasn't a god at the time. It took a couple hundred years for us to get that kind of delusion stuck in our head, and just a few years after that for the anti-Stratfordian delusion to join it.
Did you have to read all the plays to get the language and the cadences right?
I didn't have to. See, there you go. Now, I think that's very interesting. He's the greatest writer of all time. Did you have to read all the plays?
No, I didn't mean it that way. I meant, I was going to compliment you because you mentioned some forgeries of the past, and pretty much every critic has said that you have pulled it off a lot better than anybody else, that you really got into the rhythms and the way Shakespeare rhymed, and there are even some lines that you've written that might make people wonder whether they couldn't have been written by Shakespeare.
We can end the interview right there. I don't think there's anything.
You happy?
I'm very happy. I'm going to go home now.
You don't read your reviews?
Reviews? No interest to a writer. I read the one review, but that's it. Yes, I've read all the reviews. I don't comment on the blog posts if I can help it. I did read all the plays. I read them in one of the suggested orders of possible composition, and I read them out loud. And as I tend to work in cafes, I apparently read them out loud in public. So I was at a table muttering to myself as I read thousands of pages of Shakespeare. And they laugh at me. That's the sound they made in the cafe. To read them in order, possibly the order that he wrote them, is to grow up with him, and it's to watch him change from the guy who would think Two Gentlemen of Verona was funny to the guy who would think King Lear is tragic. Mm-hmm. And that's a life story in itself, and to me a fascinating life story. Also, it is the development of style. It's the development of how his rhythms change and how he uses verse differently over those 25 years.
Well, most forgers try to pass off their work as an early work. Van Meegeren claimed that his Vermeers were before Vermeer really hit his stride.
Exactly.
And only now that we look at them and we think, how could anybody have believed that? But
right.
You've done a pretty good job here. So is it because, I mean, is this a pastiche kind of thing? I mean, were you thinking about, I'll take a little from this, a little from that? Or were you also trying to do something that would have been like an early play?
I did try to fit it into a particular point in his development. I tried to write a play. It's the King Arthur story.
Is it important that the name is Arthur and your name is Arthur? Because you're playing so much with names here.
It did certainly become important as the book went on. As I started the project, I just thought, I'm going to just read them all now. I'm going to read them out loud. I'm going to listen to that woman laugh at me. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to... It's like mother's milk to me now. And I'm going to... I'm going to see what feels like didn't get written. I mean, one of the things a forger does is he or she says to himself, what is the thing that I know my subject did not do but could have done?
Mm-hmm. So you're filling in a blank.
You're filling in a blank that no one noticed existed before. So in the case of Van Meegeren, which you mentioned is very interesting, he thought, well, the blank is before Vermeer learned how to paint, apparently, and they all look off. My realization as I went on was that King Arthur is mentioned several times in Shakespeare's plays. And I found out, to my great pleasure, that a King Arthur play had been written about 1597-98 by the rival company almost literally across the street. They had a King Arthur play. And we know that when the Admiral's men put on one kind of play. Shakespeare's group, the Chamberlain's men, would put on a kind of play. You do Henry V over there, well, we've got a Henry V over here. They had a King Arthur play. There should be one.
Shakespeare should have written one.
He's a lazy guy.
Well, maybe he didn't. I'm still not sure that this isn't written by Shakespeare.
You're here.
Do you want to participate? Yes, go ahead.
Given that you have some feelings about how Shakespeare should be understood, how would you recommend teaching it in the schools?
Wow, I would be very wary of recommending how anyone should teach anything to anybody.
We studied Julius Caesar, which is not my favorite play by Shakespeare. I don't know why that's the one that they teach you in high school, or did when I went to high school.
Because people stab each other.
Uh-huh.
It's awesome. My dad can recite vast chunks of poetry and Shakespeare and Andrew Marvell's to his coy mistress and stuff that he learned when he was in 10th grade and quite a bit younger. Not literally a forger. He's a lawyer. But
only slightly criminal.
And by my generation, you know, we read Macbeth and we read Hamlet and nobody liked it. And I don't know what's going on now. My sons are too young to find out, but we'll find out in a few years what's still being taught. I don't know how you teach it. I think the only way you can teach literature is to continually present lots of different literature and say, a lot of people before you really, really love this, and here's why I, as a teacher, really, really love this. But if you don't like it, it's okay. We're going to move on to something soon. I don't know another way to do it.
Well, since your father came up, throughout the book, Arthur is trying to come to terms with his father and how he's been disappointed by him. Can you describe his father and talk a little bit about his life as a con artist?
The narrator,
kind of like Jeffrey Wolfe's father.
The narrator's father, it's been mentioned before, yeah. The narrator's father, also Arthur Phillips, has spent a lot of time during Arthur the narrator's life in prison for various counterfeiting crimes. He signed an unsigned drawing, Rembrandt, that got him in a certain amount of trouble. But he also forged New York lottery tickets and wine labels and things like that.
Coupons.
Sorry?
Coupons.
No. And so there's a big coupon scandal as well. He started out as an artist. He was just a painter, and he was doing sort of John Singer Sargent-y kind of things, and they never quite took, and he had to make a living somehow, and this seemed like a good idea, and one thing led to another. And the narrator is frustrated with the fact that his father, who could have been a great artist, ended up being a great forger, except that the definition of a great forger is you don't get caught all the time. And so he spends his life bemoaning the fact that his father spent so much time in prison.
He also has a twin sister, Dana, and she inspired one commenter on our website to ask, are you a twin?
I'm not a twin. I'm married to a twin.
Uh-huh.
And Shakespeare had twins of his own. One died very young. And twins turn up in several of the plays.
Brother and sister twins, usually, and we have a brother and sister twin here.
In the audience?
No, I meant in your book.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Not literally here.
Although
yes,
Shakespeare's
that's right.
Female twins could pass themselves off as male, they were never lesbians, as your twin is in this book.
He missed out on a lot of the lesbian mm-hmm. action, Shakespeare. Girl-on-girl stuff, really, to me, is where the future's at. At any rate.
But, you know, that it is interesting that you're echoing a lot of Shakespeare's themes, but then you're also playing with them.
Yeah, as a narrator who says, I have nothing to do with this playwright. Shakespeare is not important to me. He's not important to my life, and I refuse to accept that it affects me, and yet all around him are echoes of the plays, starting with his own birth.
Your narrator, as we've already ascertained, is named Arthur Phillips. He's written the same novels that you have, Prague, The Egyptologist, The Song Is You. I assume most readers, when they're reading it, wonder where you draw the line between fact and fiction.
They may very well wonder that.
Well, I mean, this is not a new thing. Proust named his protagonist Marcel and played with that, and a lot of writers have since. But few have done it as much as you here, where you include the names of your editor, the publisher, and a lot of other people, real people, and the names of your books.
The technical reason is a little bit boring. My hope was that when someone read this whole thing and got to the play, their defenses would be down. Mm-hmm. And they would say, oh, okay, now I am a little bit confused. What am I looking at and what am I reading? And that they would give it just enough of a chance. Because if you go into this venture and you say, all right, this is incredibly arrogant and hubristic, and why would somebody bother this? And I refuse to take this seriously, and I know it's going to be terrible because it can't be Shakespeare, because Shakespeare is, as we all know, the greatest writer who ever lived. Then I can't win. But if you go in a little bit puzzled, and you're not entirely sure how much of it's a pastiche, or maybe there is a lost piece, or it's somebody else, it is an Elizabethan drama, but the names got changed, or then that mystery is enough to produce a world of wonder, I think. And that's something that, novels used to be objects of wonder. They didn't say on the cover, this is fiction, don't believe it. Mm-hmm. They said, this is a collection of letters that I found, or this is an edited memoir that I found, and I don't understand how much of it's true or not.
Daniel Defoe, he's always discovering manuscripts written by prostitutes and other people.
I think people just left manuscripts around all the time in those days. It's hard to find them now. In this book, it turns out that I do find
one. You haven't
one.
Looked in my drawer. Have a couple. It'll never be published.
And yet, so, I am of the 21st century. I do believe that memoirs should be written by people who are trying to tell the truth. I do believe that novels should be written by people who are trying to make up stories. And yet, we have lost in that, I think, that moment of wonder in which you open a book and you don't know what you're getting. You don't know what could happen. And so, I'm not going to tell you where the line is.
We have a question over here.
Plot questions, one little one and one more complicated. The little one is Arthur, the narrator, by putting in those footnotes, I wondered if he violated the will and therefore lost the money. The bigger question is the father of the narrator. He is a pictures guy. Everything he does is visual, 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 visual. So why should anybody believe that he is a poet? Because there's no other evidence of him excelling in writing or words in the novel.
So I'll take the second question first, which brings up a larger point. If you haven't read the book, and if this is truly like a book club, nobody's read the book.
They will.
Right, and also half of you are drunk and possibly making eyes at each other across the room. But to answer the second question first... The book ends on a somewhat mysterious note, and it is not clarified. I don't want to ruin anyone's experience, so don't. If you want an answer, maybe don't go out and buy the book or wait for the paperback. But it is not clarified who wrote this play in the back of the book. And one of the possibilities is Shakespeare, and one of the possibilities is the narrator's father, and there are some other possibilities as well. And the lady has asked a question pointing out that the evidence points away from the narrator's father at one point, and I won't argue with you on that point. Well, that takes a whole book to explain, but the narrator has reasons for believing that his father would pull just this sort of scam, whether or not he's got poetic chops to pull it off or not.
And you even produce a little bit of evidence. I don't want to do spoilers here either, but there are reasons to think Arthur may be right.
Although
all of the experts have looked at the paper and have looked at the handwriting and have looked at the play and they've decided that it's the real thing.
You can't argue with experts, except that I guess we should point out that all the experts said those were real Vermeers by Van Meegeren until he stood up in court one day and painted one for them.
But they were Nazis. We don't really count them. You use a lot of real names. What about the scholars? Do you use real scholars' names?
Real scholars do appear in the book. You will notice that phrasing is... very carefully done so that they don't actually have to ruin their scholastic reputations by approving the play.
Did any of them look at the play?
I had a lot of help from serious scholars. James Shapiro, David Crystal, Ward Elliott at the Shakespeare Clinic in California. These are real serious people who should not have allowed me to bandy their names about so lightly.
And did they say to you, Arthur, Shakespeare wouldn't have said it this way, he might have said it that way?
They were very good. Two of them were good enough to read drafts and make comments. And in Professor Shapiro's case, draft after draft, he was good enough to put up with. And he was helped me short-circuit the process enormously. He sent the first draft back, and all it said on the top was 20% fewer adjectives. you're allowed one alliteration per act, no more. And then he just circled words that bothered him. And I wrote back and I said, but those are all words that Shakespeare used. And he said, I don't care. They bother me. They don't seem right. He wouldn't have used them like that. And then I knew we were getting into the Shakespeare.
No, but that's what makes it that's what makes it feel like the real deal.
Exactly.
We have another question over here. Yes.
Question, which has to do with purist Shakespeare. I mean, one of the things that I think is wonderful is Shakespeare in the Park, and there's a group, Hudson Valley Shakespeare in Baskerville, and they make the plays come to life, and they have humor, they have songs, and so my daughter, unlike myself, grew up loving Shakespeare. She also had a teacher who helped that, and she went to London to see Shakespearean plays. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. And I was mentioning that to somebody. He said, oh, no, it should be just performed just as written. So I'm curious where you, do you know what I'm saying, where you stand in that? Because to me, when productions take, I don't know if you'd call them liberties or whatever, they make them real, they make them understandable. I think it's great. It's a great gift to enjoy Shakespeare and to laugh and to, and so where do you, how did that factor into your play?
You know, the plays don't have much by way of stage direction in them. So that if you read them, it's very, the action is very much in the words, and sometimes that has to really be teased out. And a great production, as you say, teases out all kinds of things that you just won't get when you're reading it, because the people who are doing the teasing are professionals. They have read it over and over and over again, they've performed it over, they've studied previous performances, and they've got all kinds of ideas boiling over, and I think that's exactly how any play should be handled. A play is a blueprint for something that appears on stage.
But I've always wondered what Shakespeare would think if he saw some of these productions today. He might be very pleased that that people keep on finding new things in them, or he might be horrified that they have so misrepresented him.
You know, it's a wonderful projection game. It's hard to imagine that any writer is going to say, 400 years later and they're still putting on my plays, but they're doing a kind of crappy job. We like the royalties where I come from, so I don't think he's going to complain about it.
A commenter left this question on our show page. He said, I love how Shakespeare is interwoven in the text of the novel. Will the play be performed at the Guthrie, the Delacorte, the Globe, the Swan, or the Royal Shakespeare Theater?
Yeah, all of those are open. The Guerrilla Shakespeare Project, which is a troupe of Shakespeareans here in New York, a fantastic group, did a staged reading of it at the Public last month, and we are, I hope, marching towards a full-scale production. There are also readings happening in other theaters around the country.
And they might find all sorts of things in it that the playwright didn't even realize.
I watched them rehearse. You know, they had very little time for a stage reading. I watched them do three rehearsals, and each time it became a fuller and more rich experience. So I can't wait for real actors to get their claws into it.
We have another question from over here. This is the side where people have questions. Have you noticed?
Huh.
I don't know what happened to these people. I think they fell asleep.
Just to get back to the question of authenticity between either Arthur and his father, or even you and Arthur, and then Arthur and Shakespeare. What I eventually got to a point where it didn't matter anymore. Just accepted
great.
It. What were you saying about authorship and authenticity in that sense?
I was just about to ask this question. Really? Thank you.
Kid's got a future in radio. I do believe, as the character in the book states, it doesn't matter who wrote it or anything. And if you like it, it's good, and if you don't like it, it's bad. And that's the only real working definition of good and bad that to me makes any sense at all. And if you don't like it, but then someone says, well, actually, it was written by a genius, it doesn't and shouldn't change anything. And if you liked the Van Meegerens before you knew they were forgeries, then you can still like them now. It just turns out Vermeer didn't paint them. But that's very hard, I think, for most people to keep in mind. And I think everybody at some point is affected by the brand name, and whether the brand name is Shakespeare or Vermeer or whatever, they start to think, well, it isn't as good as I thought it was because it isn't by the brand.
But there are two sides to this. On the one hand, if let's say I bought a Matisse and then discovered it was a forgery, one of the attractions is the fact that this great artist did this thing. It was his hand. So that would be lost. On the other hand, if it was a work of real beauty, then you could ask, well, what's
well, it depends why you bought it. If you bought it because you thought it was a work of real beauty,
well,
then
wouldn't I buy it for both reasons?
Well, yeah, but that's the problem. We use the word value to mean two very different things. value means how much I can get for it, and value means how much it means to me. But it's very rare that those track in a perfect parallel. And what happens in the case of a forgery is we suddenly find out that they're miles apart from each other, and our instinct as people is to say, well, in that case, I guess it means a lot less to me than I thought it did. But actually, all that matters is that you can't sell it for as much as you paid for it.
Yes. Peter left a question on our show page. He said, while I was, this is long, so forgive me. While I was reading Prague, I had, try to stay awake.
Sorry.
No, it's actually a really good question. Right, That's okay. Why I'm reading it.
Right.
While I was reading Prague, I happened to see the new Woody Allen movie, Midnight in Paris, and I was struck by the similarity between the main point of the Allen film, that people who yearn for more authentic times when things seem better perhaps would not feel the same way if they knew that those times gone by were just as inauthentic as the present, and that people then, too, were nostalgic for some past era. And one of the conclusions arrived at by the character Mark in Prague, whose research about nostalgia yields a similar insight. I don't know if you've seen the Woody Allen film.
I haven't. Is the implication that Allen has ripped me off yet again?
Actually, he thought you were Shakespeare.
First it was Sleeper.
No, but this is about authenticity and inauthenticity as well.
Yes, it is. There's a more likely, I guess, is that we share common interests. You know, I am someone who has a nostalgic sense for places that I've never been and times I never lived. And lately it's been for Elizabethan England, a place where I would have been strung up as a Jew and whipped or something. And yet, for some reason, it seems really wonderful. Yes, there is a feeling that there must have been some other time where authentic art was being made by authentic geniuses. And if I were there, if I were in the midst of all that, I would feel, therefore, authentic. It never was, and it never happened.
Well, actually, I didn't read the complete quote because it was going on so long, but he said, as a matter of fact, both discussed the idea of artists hanging out at cafes and why that tradition developed. I was wondering if Mr. Phillips was aware of the parallel and if he thinks Woody Allen might have almost literally taken a page or two from his book. See, there are people who are out there defending you.
Against the onslaught of Woody Allen plagiarism. I very much appreciate the defense.
So, I don't want to go into too many details about the plot here, but one of the things I found slightly disconcerting was that you gloss over Arthur's marriage and the fact that he had two kids, and for most people that would be a very important part of their story. Was there a reason you did that?
There was. The first part of the book, it purports to be a memoir.
And it's a memoir and an introduction at the same time.
It's an introduction to a new Shakespeare play, which breaks down into a memoir of someone's life. And the reason that he does not go into certain aspects of it is because he's not responsible for those parts in relation to the whole story. And so we have to get through them, but I don't want to give anything away either, but there's a reason that he's writing this memoir, and his marriage and kids are not part of that reason. Mm-hmm. And so we move through it rather quickly. Just a technical
question over here.
Well, this is a book club, and in book club we say, I really love this book. And I really do think, even though the play is interesting, the novel part of it, your memoir part of it, all the things that go together were just so wonderful. So I really recommend this book to everybody.
Thank you.
But you didn't have any questions for Arthur?
She doesn't have to say another word. Why are you pushing her?
I asked him this before, but I asked him, how does your winning Jeopardy, have anything to do with writing Prague? Or, how do those two things go together? Or do they go together?
There are certain parallels between game show triumph and novel writing. They are both avoidance of real work. They are both desperate efforts to make money through vast but very shallow knowledge. I know a lot of things very slightly, and a few facts about all kinds of stuff and nothing in depth. When I write fiction, it's a very free association. Something reminds me of something else. And I think possibly my tendency towards trivia is that as well. Things free associate, and I'm able to move from one topic to another. Again, skating pretty shallowly over the surface, but giving the impression of knowledge. And, you know, writing novels is giving the impression that you know an infinite amount about the lives of these people that you've made up, when in fact it's just sometimes just a few details put in a certain order that makes people go, oh yeah, I know that person. And sometimes that's sort of like trivia.
But you are creating the world, so you can, since you're inventing it, you can decide what's important in the world or not.
It's true. It's a wonderful thing to be able to say, this is how I'm going to describe everybody, and this is the amount of detail everyone's going to have, and this is the shape the book is going to take. Realizing that you can do anything you want in writing fiction is one of the great discoveries of my life. It's not like I was the first person to realize it, but that realization, well, I can do anything I want here, and it's always right because I like it. Until someone tells me later on how stupid it is. But for now, it's all right.
I mentioned Nabokov's Pale Fire earlier. I'm assuming that that was one of your inspirations.
It has been for years. I read it first. I've probably read it three times now, and the first time I read it was 15 or 20 years ago, and that moment of realization happened for me in reading that book. There are no rules here. We're talking about a novel which takes the form of a poem and the footnotes to the poem, and the footnotes to the poem tell a bizarre and completely unrelated story. And that
brilliantly, by the way.
Brilliantly. And that moment of reading this book that I didn't know anything about other than it was by the guy who wrote Lolita, and I liked Lolita, so let's see what this is. And suddenly I realized, wow, this is not, you don't have to write Once Upon a Time, and then this happened, and this happened, and then the antagonist, and the protagonist, and then the resolution, and then we learn a lesson, and the end. There's an infinite number of things you can do under the name fiction, and that, to me, has been the adventure of my life.
Another question.
Was I influenced by David Foster Wallace's use of footnotes? I read Infinite Jest not long after it came out, so I guess that was 10 or a dozen years ago. And it certainly was, it was very different, obviously, than how Nabokov did it. It didn't seem to me like something I wanted to steal from. I liked Infinite Jest a great deal, and I think he's a wonderful, wonderful writer and a wonderful book, but it didn't go into that little influence hole somehow.
And is that something that actually occurs to you? You'll be reading something and thinking, you know, I'm going to steal something from this?
No, it doesn't feel like
because
now I'm going to steal.
Because didn't T.S. Eliot say something about really great writers totally plagiarize?
It doesn't feel like I'm going to take that. It feels more like I've done it. It's happened enough times that I know what it feels like. It feels like I say to myself, that's a friend of mine writing that book. That's mm-hmm. the first thing that happens.
Kindred spirit.
That is somebody we would get along just fine. And that happened with me and Shakespeare, but only as I was working on this book. It hadn't happened before.
So you really did come to love Shakespeare while you were working on the book.
Yeah, very much. But in the same way that I came to love Nabokov, and then I've come to love people who are still around and whose books suddenly grabbed me. And I realized I didn't think of that, but I could have, and I wish I had.
Another question.
One of the essentials.
No?
For
wasn't there a hand?
Yeah, over here.
Oh, here. Go ahead.
No, the guy with the microphone, I think, should.
Hi. One of the essentials of Shakespeare for me is periodically I'm going to find a word that would make absolutely no sense, a phrase that would make absolutely no sense unless there was a footnote or a concordance, whatever. Did you go out of your way to make sure that there were occasional archaic, obsolete, obscure words that you needed a footnote for?
Yes, I did, absolutely. It's not a Shakespeare play without words that you don't use anymore. And in some cases, it's not a Shakespeare play without a word that the footnotes say, meaning obscure. And so one of my great pleasures is that in Act 1, Scene 2, the shepherdess turns to King Arthur and calls him a turn melon.
But didn't you also, wanting us to suspect that this might not be the real thing, throw in some things that would suggest it was a forgery?
Yes. There are, it turns out, quotes from poems that were written maybe 150 years after Shakespeare. But it seems possible that actually Pope just stole them from this Shakespeare play. Actually, my happiest moment in terms of both footnotes and things like that, I realized, okay, we have to have a certain number of apples, because Shakespeare always has apples. We have to have a certain number of flowers that from the Warwickshire district where he grew up. And so, and I have to find, because this is a forgery and something he didn't do, I have to find a flower from the English Midland that he didn't use. Mm. This is the sort of thing that makes me very happy because I'm a trivia brain. So I spent a happy day looking for flowers from the English Midlands that he didn't use. And I found one and worked it into this scene. And then I found another reference to it that turned out that in Elizabethan England they had used it, they grinded it down to make a hemorrhoid paste. So I said, well, there's a footnote. So we have now King Arthur is speaking to, he's courting his future wife, Guinevere, and talks about these wildflowers and how his nurse did once make a private paste of it. I have never, maybe in my entire marriage, birth of my children, aside from those, I have never been so happy as the day of the hemorrhoid paste.
And why did you name her Guinevere instead of Guinevere?
She's named Guinevere in the source material that Shakespeare would have used. Uh-huh. He would have used Holland's Edge Chronicles, and in Holland's Edge Chronicles, Arthur marries Guinevere.
We have a question over here.
So you had to inhabit Shakespeare's writing style in order to create this book. Did you find that it changed your writing style formally as well?
I'm a pretty pretentious person, but I will stop before I say, and now I write much more like Shakespeare. When I was working on the play itself, I was, you know, desperately trying to make it more and more Shakespearean. It didn't seem to leach into my own prose writing very much. What I fell in love with as I was reading him was a feeling like, maybe we had the same sense of humor about a certain thing, or maybe he would have done this, or maybe he would have done that. So I was projecting myself onto him as much as I allowed him to project himself back onto me, I guess. There are a couple sentences in the introduction that I noticed afterwards. They were iambic, but I think it was pretty rare, and for the most part, he stayed over on that side and I stayed on this side.
We're talking a lot about the play, but most of this book is the memoir introduction, and you had a lot of fun with all the different plot twists and turns. Some of them, I guess, we could see coming, others were total surprises. That's part of what you're all about here, isn't it? Playing with the reader's expectations. I mean, do you think about that when you're writing, or
no? You get a special benefit if you just think about surprising yourself. And if you read a lot, then you say, I don't want to do that. I've seen that too many times, and you cross it off. And you say, well, what if the opposite happened? What if instead of the thing that first comes to mind, let's pick something else? And then of course you revise 10, 20, 30 times. So if at the end of the 30th revision you're still snickering to yourself, then someone else will find it funny or surprising or non-predictable or whatever else. I don't think you can convincingly think about some imaginary reader out there and then as a result make all the readers happy. I don't know what book does that.
We're running out of time. If there are any other questions, now's your turn. Now's your...
A question for you. How did you get into writing, and what inspired you to write about Shakespeare and write this book?
Writing itself was kind of accidental. I know a lot of people at 8 and 10 and 12 and 14 know they're going to be novelists. I got into it very late. And I stumbled into it because I was doing other kinds of writing professionally. Like, I was a good writer in high school. I could write papers. And then I ended up in speech writing and advertising writing and PR writing. And it was very boring. But I found out, wow, I can write every day on demand. I could do this. I would just like to try to write something more interesting. And so in my spare time, I started to write my first novel just to see what would happen. It was kind of an experiment. And it turned out, wow, I like this, and I'm good at this, and this is much better than what I'm doing that I'm getting paid for. So that'll be my hobby. So that's how I fell into novel writing. And as far as this one, I don't know. I walk the dogs a lot and listen to music, and then something hits you. And I've done this long enough now that I recognize those moments. I could spend 2 years thinking about that. And that's all it is at the beginning. Wow, that's odd. I haven't read that book before or thought about something like that or seen that image or just that little scene before. What would happen now? And then 2 years later, you're in a nice radio station and everyone's paying attention to you.
In front of a wonderful audience.
Exactly.
And we thank you all for participating in the first of the Leonard LoPage Show Book Club events. And Arthur, thank you so much. You were the perfect first person to talk about.
Thank you. And